right. Thanks for the introductions. Great to be visiting Santa Barbara. So Yara asked me to make this talk fairly introductory, since I'm the first person who's going to be mentioning polylogarithms in this program. I'm going to be talking about work that I've been doing over the last few years in collaboration with Lance Dixon, James Drummond, Jeff Pennington, and more recently, Andrew McLeod, Simone Carenfo, and very recently, some work in progress with Yorgos Papathanasio and the others which I'm probably going to be at least briefly mentioning at the end of the talk. Okay, so the core idea here. We've got methods to compute integrands, we've got methods to use those integrands to integrate, but wouldn't it be nice to just have some basis of functions that we want for the amplitude, constrain it with some physical data, and just arrive at the amplitude without ever having to integrate any Feynman integrals? That's...
depends how nice the basis is, how big it is.
Exactly. And so thus, sometimes you can do this, sometimes you can't. But in planar N equal 4 super Yang Mills, for six particle amplitudes, you can. And that's because planar N equal 4 is a very well-behaved theory. So there are sort of two things about the theory that make us able to do this kind of method. There are the symmetries, and there's the niceness of the basis of functions. So in this talk, first I'll talk about the symmetries, then I'll talk about the functions. Okay. So this will be old hat for some of you, but for some of you, it'll be less familiar. In N equal 4 super Yang Mills, you can write down some endpoint amplitude. But in the planar limit, as it turns out, this expression is also the expression for a Wilson loop, specifically a polygonal Wilson loop, with corners separated by distances equal to the amplitude momentum. Now, this Wilson loop is also in planar N equal 4 super Yang Mills. So in addition to the conformal symmetry that should act on these momenta when it's interpreted as an amplitude, you also need to be able to act on these interpreted as positions. And that pair of symmetries, the original conformal symmetry and this conformal symmetry in this dual space, gives what is known as dual conformal symmetry. And this turns out to rather dramatically constrain what these objects can actually look like. So because this Wilson loop is in a conformal theory, it can only have divergences when when the boundary of the Wilson loop is breaking conformal invariance at the cusps. So these cusps completely control the UV divergences of the Wilson loop. But as such, because of this duality, they also control the IR divergences of the amplitude. And more generally, they control all of the breaking of dual conformal symmetry. And this breaking, the behavior at these cusps, is fully understood. So it allowed Bern, Dixon, and Smirnov to write down what's known as the BDS ansatz, which contains all of this breaking of all of the UV divergences in the Wilson loop space, all of the IR divergences in the amplitude space, and more generally, all of the breaking of dual conformal invariants. I know this is sort of a rushed presentation of this, but there's more to get to.
Sorry, but what do you mean by breaking? I mean, mm-hmm. The configuration of the loop, you would never expect the configuration of the loop to be invariant under the conformal symmetry. So what exactly do you mean by,
what I mean is that this, when you calculate the Wilson loop, it'll be some quantity that's invariant under this dual conformal symmetry with some correction term that's entirely determined by the cusps. So the only part of the expression that's not dual conformal invariant.
But that little line segment is not invariant.
The point is that it's a light-like polygon, and so this is covariant under. So a light-like polygon is mapped to another light-like polygon under the conformal transformations.
Right.
That's why you expect some symmetry in the first place. But then the breaking is due to the UV divergences. So geometrically, it's clear that there should be some symmetry, but it's the difficult part is to understand if whether or not the breaking is controlled if you go away from four dimensions in dimensional regularization.
I'm just confused there. If you act with a dual conformal symmetry on this polygon, it moves the whole polygon to another one, right? Including the edges, the vertices, everything.
Yes. So you can consider an infinitesimal transformation, and that gives you a differential equation for your for the expectation value when you evaluate the Wilson loop on that polygon.
Is the confusion just covariant versus invariant? Is that the
I think what's being said is that you would expect this to transform as a representation. Of course, it's not invariant, it's covariant.
Yeah. So.
And that somehow something happens at the corners that it's not even a representation.
Right.
Because even the edges are not in, right? So.
So is that the correct statement?
Yes, no, that should be the correct statement. Yeah, that there's a covariance, but the corners are breaking even that.
Transformation can be completely undone by a change of variables in the path integral.
Yeah.
The problem is that the change of variable is anomalous because we're not in four dimensions. But if we were in four dimensions, it would be a strict invariant. It's an invariant.
The expectation value.
Yes. The object you calculate when you calculate the Wilson loop.
Okay.
Not the loop itself, yes. Okay. Now, so this contains all of the behavior that violates the symmetry. So.
It's a real symmetry of ratios and angles. At least not the super hard dual conformal, right? It's the fact is that it's universal. The infrared divergences are physical, they're meaningful, and they also are universal. So the ratio of any two particular amplitudes with n particles is going to be invariant under this dual conformal symmetry, or covariant under this dual conformal symmetry. But the breaking is completely independent of the particulars of the process. So it cancels the ratio. And it exponentiates according to CDF's nonsense.
Yes. So since this.
Sorry, with the same language, the original conformal symmetry is also broken by the scattering input. Is the original conformal symmetry also broken?
Yes,
but it's broken in a very complicated way. The dual conformal symmetry is broken in a very simple way. I mean, for reasons that I don't really understand, but just the way it is.
Yeah, the dual conformal breaking exponentiates in a nice, clean way, but not the normal way.
Technically, you can understand the difference from the fact that these dual conformal generators, they are first order, and it's a bit easier to understand how the breaking understands for first order, how the breaking occurs for such operators. When you consider the original conformal symmetry in momentum space, it acts as second order generators. Say in twister space, d lambda tilde, or just second order in original momentum. And that's harder to understand.
Yeah, it's a priori, it's not obvious that it works this way. Anyway.
Okay. So once you have this ansatz, you might ask, okay, is this in fact just the full answer? Is this just the Wilson loop or the amplitude? It isn't, but the first chance it has to not be the amplitude is at 6 points. So for 4 points or for 5 points, you could write down, you could try to write down some sort of dual conformal invariant cross ratio, but you wouldn't be able to find any. There just aren't any dual conformal invariant functions of the Mandelstams that you can write down for 4 points or for 5 points. So the first time you can write down anything non-trivial is at 6 points. So 6 points is the first time that there can be some correction to the BDS ansatz. And it depends on these three dual conformal invariant cross ratios, which are described as U, V, and W. So in each case, we've got a ratio of some two-particle invariants and some three-particle invariants. And I'll just write all three of them down because it might be handy later. So U is S12, S45 over S123, S345. V is S23, S56 over S234, S123, and W is S34, S61 over S345, S234. Okay. Now, so any correction to the BDS ansatz has to depend on these three variables. There are other variables you can write down that are some combination of these. One thing that's going to be useful later are what we refer to as Y variables. And the key aspect of these is that unlike UVW, these things are parity odd. So let me just write down one of them rather than writing down all of them. If you're not familiar with moment and twister four brackets, I can give a brief explanation, but essentially what you get is an expression like this for one of these variables. And the others are just cyclic permutations.
Again, by parity, you mean flip of the polygon, right? Not space-time parity.
Yeah, so was, right, so there was some confusion about this, but...
And you don't mean literal cyclic permutation, because rotating YU turns it into 1 over Y.
This is true, yeah. Yeah, so I guess under two cycles, because these are odd, yeah. Okay. So that's what the symmetries of the space tell us, that we have a function that depends on these variables, which if we wanted, we could express in these instead. Fine. That's not enough to build an ansatz on its own, but luckily, the functions involved are also very well behaved. In particular, they have transcendental weight, of 2 times the loop order. Now, what is transcendental weight? Well, the simplest cases, it's literally just a power of pi. So pi to the n has transcendental weight n. The nth zeta value, which I should make sure I'm actually right.
The elliptic function is transcendental weight 1. That
means the elliptic function. That means the elliptic function is transcendental weight. Who knows?
Yeah.
But since it's not literally pi to the n.
No, but elliptic. Come on, leave it alone. Okay. Evaluated mathematically, it's pi, just like Planck does.
At some point, sure.
At a rational and an integer.
Okay. The nth Riemann zeta value also has transcendental weight n. If it's even, this is obvious. It's proportional to pi to the n. If it's odd, it's not obvious, but we define it so that, again, it has transcendental weight n.
So zeta 3 divided by pi cubed is a non-transcendental one.
So zeta 3 divided by pi cubed luckily never shows up. Okay. You can already sort of guess what how functions should behave under this. So log to the n has transcendental weight n. To write down something slightly more complicated, the nth classical polylogarithm has transcendental weight n. Now, as some of you at least probably know, if you take the derivative of these things, they're li n minus 1 d log z, where this thing is recursive, and it's defined around the initial li 1, which is minus log 1 minus z. So these objects have branch cuts at z equals 1, and that's determined by this innermost li, and then the others are all essentially integrating d log z up to get to the next one. So this is the simplest example. We can be slightly more general, though. We can instead write down what are called harmonic polylogarithms, which have some weight vector. And in the cases that we deal with for these, for this hexagon problem, usually the harmonic polylogs that come up have a weight vector composed of zeros and ones. So if there's a zero in front of this weight vector, then we peel off, if we take a derivative, we peel off the zero and get a d log z. If instead there's a 1, there's a minus sign due to convention, but we peel off this and get a d log 1 minus c.
So can I ask, is there a reason why the log of 2 actually doesn't show up? Because in principle, it's in the R.
It does in g minus 2.
It does in certain contexts, luckily not in this one. But yes, I mean, there are certain limits you can take where log 2s will show up or other things like that.
You don't get it like zeta 2, it's not a coefficient.
It's not a coefficient, yeah. It's not
is
some...
there any reason?
It comes up in plenty of quantum field theories.
I know, but not here. Not here, yeah.
Right.
Not here, so is there any a priori reason why you wouldn't expect?
Yeah, I mean...
alternating sum, but not as a Euler sum. Basically, if you're in a space, it needs alternating sums of money.
Right, so I think if your question is, why doesn't the space need alternating sums? In some sense, all of this is empirical anyway. Right, the fact that this is transcendental weight 2L is already something that at least there are strong arguments for, but is not exactly something that's been definitively proven.
Yeah, but it shows that it's kind of stronger than just...
Yes. Yes. No, and this is a fair point to make, that in any particular context, we're going to need to be a little more specific. So yeah, in this particular ansatz that I'm going to be building, actually, pi to the n doesn't generically show up. It shows up if it's a value of zeta n, but we're not allowed to add pi cubed times some function, for example.
But there's overwhelming evidence that this in four-dimensional quantum field is the upper bound of transcendentality.
Yes, that much is true too, yeah. Okay, so you guys can kind of see a pattern here.
Sorry, isn't the statement somehow that you only have zeros and one related to the fact that we expect that you only have two particle similarities in the amplitude? If you choose your particular variables, right, you will see that any of the singularities c and 1 minus c just corresponds to all possible two particle singularities.
In specific variables, yes, not in these variables. So in these variables, 1 minus c doesn't correspond to a two-particle singularity. It corresponds to some weird point where, you can sort of see in these cross ratios, right? So if 1 minus u vanishes, then this is equal to 1, which it's like that doesn't really correspond to an obviously meaningful physical point. So the fact that these are zeros and ones,
you could take the square root of c, right? And you would just reproduce automatically 1 plus c as well in the new basis, right?
I mean, it depends on where you're taking an integration base point to be. Because your statement is correct if you're thinking about HPLs in terms of arguments or the Mandelstams or whatever. But if you integrate it off of some random base point, of course you can get what
no,
you want.
Okay, sure.
So it's kind of a basis dependent question.
Yes.
Well, I think the statement is that you can represent all your functions within their similarities only with zeros and ones.
Not manifestly in the endpoint case, I would say.
Yeah.
Hopefully. In the 6-point case, it's kind of trivialized, I agree. This is a statement you can make here.
Yeah. I mean, generically, these are a subset of the functions we need anyway. This isn't the full space. The full space is a very natural generalization of all of the things I've been writing down. Let's say we have some f, some function. It has weight n. Its derivative is some sum of terms. Each term, a function of weight n minus 1, d log some rational function s, where what these things are rational functions of.
So if you didn't write d log, then I would have been happy. This is, of course, what you wrote is, of course, valid for 6 particles and 7 particles, probably a lot of NME3, but it's not very good.
I should specify. Yeah, so I should specify.
You wrote d f1 or something. Log rational. I think
okay, does this make you happy? Or does that not fix the problem?
It correctly limits the scope of the discussion.
Past MHV and NMHV, you can start having elliptic functions. Yeah. These make your life a lot harder.
But
for 6 points.
It's constructed in this kind of way, too, so I mean, it's not
some yeah.
scary thing.
This is true. But I think for the purpose that I'm discussing things, where we want to actually have, I'm going to use this to define symbol entries. And it doesn't really make sense to have some more general elliptic stuff in there if I'm defining symbol entries. There isn't the same sense of an alphabet, as far as I understand.
You can define a coproduct. You can define that equation generalizes nicely.
Sure. But for this purpose, I do want to define an alphabet.
So for the elliptic case, there's an infinite alphabet, at least in the picture of Brown-Levin on elliptic polylogs. So I think the key idea of this equation is still goes through if you're tolerant to admit an infinite range for a summation variable I.
Sure. Yeah. But how general that is for me. I mean, it certainly works for the Q cases.
It's genus 1.
Yes.
Okay. Genus 2 might have further surprises. Who knows?
Yeah. Sorry, we're derailing you.
Fair enough. One can iterate this. So if one has another derivative acting on this, it acts on these functions, and you get fn minus 2s. In my conventions, this is going to be j comma I, so we've got some other sum over j parameterizing the next derivative that we're taking. And in general, this is all part of a very rich, nice coproduct structure. And if you keep iterating this coproduct structure, if you keep going all the way down to the point where you've just got some tensor product of d log s's, these things are referred to as the letters of the symbol. So the tensor product itself is the symbol of a function, and these objects are its letters. And for 6 points, in n equal 4, this set is fairly simple. There are 9 possibilities. We can have cross ratios. We can have 1 minus cross ratios. And we can have these y variables. And these are all of our options. Okay, so if you wanted to build a basis of all possible functions that have these properties.
Is that empirical?
Initially, it was entirely empirical. I think that there are decent arguments based on this cluster algebra structure that's been observed. But again, that's empirical.
Yeah.
It's someone else's empirical, though. I think, well, for 6 points, one can sort of see that these are, if you just try to parameterize all of the cross ratios of four brackets you can write down. This is basically the parameterization you get. You get nine objects, as long as you're just looking at cross ratios of four brackets. So in some sense, this is, for 6 points, this is intuitively what you would write down. For higher points, that sort of argument doesn't work anymore. And you do need to sort of lean on empirical, weirder stuff.
So sorry, can I ask? So this captures, you can, if you now think about the singularities not in cross ratios, but in four brackets directly, this captures all possible four brackets that you get to zero in 6 points, right?
Yes.
You can find any four bracket in one of them.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So. And is that true even for the second singularities, or that's not true? It's a two of them to zero. Can you edit pairs set to zero by setting sitting on one of the?
Oh, I see. Can you find any singularity by?
Yeah, I just want to understand. Maybe there is some argument why this is.
Oh, I mean, naively, I would expect that this is more constraining than just looking at any possible. Than just looking at any possible singularity in four brackets. I haven't looked at it in detail to see whether or not that's the case. Okay. So naively then, you could say, okay, let's say you want to build some basis of these functions. Well, the most naive thing you could possibly do is just say, okay, I've got some fn minus 1s, let's just add a d log s for every s in my basis. And just do this over and over again and build up, you know, weight or 9 to the weight functions. This doesn't work. The problem is some of the things you're writing down are not actually functions. So for example, if you're just looking at these u, v, and w variables, you might try to write down a function of the following form. Log u d log v. This, however, is not, there is no function with this derivative. So if you tried to write down something that actually has that derivative, like let's say log u log v, it would have a term like that, sure. But you also need a term log v d log u. Okay. So this is really just the very basic straightforward statement that your mixed partial derivatives need to make sense. And in general, because of that, you can't just naively go about applying something like this. You have to constrain it with this integrability constraint. So you've got that constraint. We'd still like to apply a few more constraints in order to actually get functions that make sense in scattering amplitudes. So the next relevant constraint is that of physical branch cuts. Scattering amplitudes should only have branch cuts when a momentum invariant vanishes. As we were discussing, with these UVW variables, which I've unfortunately erased, when they approach 1, that's not a situation where a momentum invariant is vanishing. When these Y variables vanish, that's not a situation where a momentum invariant vanishes. When momentum invariant vanishes, these UVW cross ratios, they either vanish or they blow up. So the branch cuts are determined by just these first three symbol entries, u, v, and w. Now remember, for the classical polylogarithms, the branch cuts were determined by the innermost object when you take derivatives. The same thing is true here. So the first entry of the symbol, the innermost entry of the symbol, has to be one of these letters. just these things. Okay. Now, when you're building things as an ansatz, this is pretty simple to enforce. You just start with log u, log v, and log w as your original basis, and then after that you can add on whatever you want. There's one small subtlety there, though, and that's what happens when you start adding in constants. So, for example, I could try to add something like zeta n minus 1 d log 1 minus u, or zeta n minus 1 d log yu. And these things, while in some sense they'd be perfectly allowed from this condition, because if you take more derivatives on them, you're taking derivatives of a constant and they just vanish. Really, you aren't allowed to add these things except in specific combinations to cancel any remaining branch cuts. So these things are entirely determined by this branch cut condition. So at each order, you're solving integrability and you're solving this. There's one final condition, which we've only applied in these more recent approaches. And those are, should probably put that there, whatever, the Steinman conditions.
I object.
Okay.
Sorry, maybe I'll let you explain what Steinman conditions are first.
Yes, that might be a good idea. Okay. So these things are a very old concept in quantum field theory. The original S-matrix program, people knew about them. They were observed by Steinman back in the 60s. But they haven't really been imposed in an amplitudes context very much so far. And essentially, the principle is the following. So let's say you look at some factorization channel of the amplitude. So let's see. Let me just make sure I've got the legs here right so that I'm actually looking at the right pair of channels. OK. So this is some singularity on S 3, 4, 5. Now, what the Steinman conditions tell you is that this, any diagram that has this factorization channel, that has this possible branch cut, cannot also have this branch cut, where here we've got 2, 3, 4, 1, 6, 5. OK, the S 2, 3, 4. So in general, what this is saying is if you take two discontinuities of the amplitude, if you take, let's say, you first take discontinuity in S 2, 3, 4, and then you take a discontinuity in S 3, 4, 5, this needs to be 0, because there's no diagram that has both discontinuities.
Is there any specific, what's the purpose, these pictures that you drew, with, like, is there any significance of the fact that you have three lines running through there?
No, that's...
No, I mean, the Steinman relations in general are basically telling you that if you look at any Feynman diagram with arbitrary endpoint, whatever, any tree graph, you can't have arbitrary combinations of S's. They have to be nested in a way.
Yeah. So no, the fact that there's three lines is just saying there can be multiple lines there.
So they were derived in the analytic S-matrix program. So this is like non-perturbative condition. They shouldn't rely on perturbation theory. Is that right?
I don't know if the initial derivation actually took that into account. I mean, the initial people who were working on this were going for eventually non-perturbative conditions,
yeah,
but to some. Right, but to some extent, these people, just like we are, observing other people's perturbative results and noticing patterns.
I mean, it's kind of a trivial thing from the diagrams.
Yeah. So, did they borrow them from diagrams?
I get the impression that was at least the initial inspiration. I don't know if there's a stronger non-perturbative argument for it. Okay. Now, if we want to enforce this, one of the simplest ways is to use a slightly different set of letters. So we can rearrange the letters as follows. So we can take...
Why do you want to enforce this?
Because it restricts our space. Because we know this has to be true, and because we can enforce it on the functions themselves.
Yeah, but okay, let me explain my objection. So the basic problem is that this is definitely, the timing constraints are definitely at properties of amplitudes, but none of the functions you actually care about, the two observables you care about, Rexion functions, are the remainder and the ratio, neither of which are amplitudes, their ratios are amplitudes. As such, they're not planar, and as such, they don't give a crap about Feynman diagrams like that. You can have nested things. And so what you're really gonna do is you're gonna redefine both the remainder function and the ratio functions to get rid of all of the crosstalk that actually is in the remainder function and the ratio function, mm-hmm. so that you can talk about the sign relations.
Yes, and when you read...
That is moving to the target.
But it doesn't matter. It's useful.
Right. It's moving...
It's not a useful constraint for the two objects of interest.
But no. At the end of the day, they're going to use it.
You can translate back to the object.
Right.
I agree.
So let me put it this way. We are calculating different objects, yeah. but we know the transformation yes. between our objects and the old ones.
Yeah.
And it's a much smaller basis.
But it's an important subtlety because it is this conceptually does not follow from what you're trying to calculate. It follows from...
It does once we've shifted things, which I'll do in a few minutes. Yeah. Okay, so we rearrange these things so that these cross ratios are in these kinds of triplets. And what these triplets do is they isolate a particular three-particle invariant. And if we do this, then what we find, and I'll just write down the other ones, V over UW, W over UV, is the Steynman conditions say these two different cannot be adjacent. So any distinct pair of these are not allowed to be adjacent in the symbol. You can't have a discontinuity in this and then a discontinuity in that. Now, initially, the way we applied this was the same sort of principle we applied for these branch cuts. We start from the beginning. We say, OK, the first two entries can't have these two next to each other. And that means that instead of the space of nine possible pairs that we would have had beforehand, so three of the first ones, six of the second ones, the y's can't appear in the first two entries for reasons that I've been leaving out, but are essentially just you can't solve integrability with them. But in fact, there are only six possible pairs. In fact, though, what we've observed recently is that this condition is even stronger. It's not just a condition on the first two entries. You can go much deeper. You can take a lot more discontinuities, and then discontinuity S234, discontinuity S345, and it still needs to vanish.
But is that due to the fact, so there's this recent paper by Claude and Einan and friends, that you can write, there's this co-product action when you write it on an integral that you get some entries and you address it with another Feynman integral. And then for that Feynman integral, which would be further back in your D-logs, or further entries in the back in the symbol, that still has to be from a Feynman integral. So for this Feynman integral, you again have Steynman constraints. Can I understand something?
Yeah, so...
Why do you want to understand some complicated way? Because that must be true anywhere in the branch cut structure.
How do you know which branch you're at like when you go down deeper down in the symbol?
I do think that work basically provides a proof for this.
Yeah.
No, that was definitely initially something that we were a little uncomfortable with, the idea that, okay, if you take all these derivatives, what you're getting might not be a Feynman integral at all. But yeah, I think that sort of work is precisely the way to demonstrate that, indeed, when you take all these discontinuities, you should still be getting something that obeys Steynman constraints.
At arbitrary depths.
Yes. And so earlier, we had some condition like this for Simon constraints. But if I'm remembering right, that's almost always, if not always, we need to look into this in more detail, enforced just by doing this correctly at all orders of the symbol. Okay. But for the numbers I'm going to be presenting you with in a bit, the size of the basis, we're just imposing this on the first two entries.
Is this an explanation for why we get the final entry function for free? Or is that something?
You don't get the entire final entry condition for free. Do you mean just the double final entry condition?
Yeah.
Probably. I mean, pairs of entries are much more constrained than they were previously. Okay. Yes, so, okay, I can skip some of this discussion since I'm running a little late, but yes, so using these rules, you can order by order build up your basis. And what you end up with is some number of functions. So that's the first line in this. It's just going to be these Simon hexagon functions from the old picture where we didn't think about the pairs as heavily. So for one loop, you're looking at weight two objects.
So it's like Simon version 1.0?
Yes.
Okay. Because you could also have another line before you knew about Simon.
Right. I've left out that line because it's long and pointless since I mentioned Simon. Okay. One loop, weight two objects, you have seven things you can write down. That's six pairs of entries and zeta two. Two loops, you have 39 objects. Three loops, 190. Four loops, 839. And five loops, 3,434. Which is certainly a lot if you were doing it by hand, but is really not so much if you're dealing with it with Mathematica. So already, Simon constraints have made our ansatz very manageable. Okay. Now, I should probably talk about what specifically we're calculating. And thus address Jake's objection from earlier.
Suppose you didn't use the Simon relations, but the numbers are?
Right, so I don't have them written down handy, but they're about an order of magnitude higher. I mean, they're not an order of magnitude higher here because there just aren't that many functions, but when you get up here, yeah, it was something like 6,000, 7,000. And I don't think we even have the number for this one. So yeah, like cutting things down by about an order of magnitude, a little less. Okay, so the question becomes, okay.
You don't have a line for for what it's gonna look like when you have the better Simon, the all pair, all depth.
Version. Not in the context of this talk. I have those numbers, I can give them to you later.
They cut it by how much? Like
about half, yeah.
About half.
So all these conditions are necessary conditions for this to be related to final parentheses.
Right. Yeah.
So you're sure you've not missed any conditions?
Yes, and in sort of independently of this, there's this sense in which later in this process we're going to have a lot of redundant constraints, and the expectation is if we were calculate if we had missed some piece of our ansatz, if there was something that was allowed but we thought it wasn't, then we'd come to a contradiction. We'd start applying constraints, and eventually we'd have something that we couldn't solve for.
The only conceivable weakness of the ansatz at this point is the possibility of something that's not polylogarithmic. So an elliptic would not fit inside this universe. But otherwise, I think they're just writing on all possible iterated polylogarithms that are related to prime diagrams.
So this would apply to which theories would
any function
planar?
No. So this is specifically planar dual conformally invariant.
Okay. I see.
Yeah. We do need dual conformal invariants.
Yeah. The transcendental way.
Transcendental. Yeah. And purely transcendental functions and yeah. Specific to a specific transcendental way. Yeah.
And there are no global issues because I mean you basically integrability is required that this one form is closed, but there are no global issues on the space of letters.
Not in the sense of making legitimate functions, no. there are potentially other such constraints, which may well be results of some of these other things I'm applying later. But everything in here is a legitimate function. You can build it up into some basis and evaluate it numerically if you want. It's well-defined. Or at least you can evaluate it numerically up to four loops or so. If you try it five, it takes a week and nothing happens.
The only subtlety that might break even for maximally transcendental weight for not the formal theory or something, for just like a general six-particle process, is maybe the finiteness of the symbol observation. Mm-hmm. But in fact, they wrote only nine letters.
Okay. So intuitively, here's what you'd want to do. You'd want to write down, let's say, the MHV amplitude, since it's the simplest in these terms, in terms of the BDS ansatz times some remainder. As Jake pointed out, though, this thing is some sort of weird non-planar object. It shouldn't be describable in terms of diagrams, and in particular, it doesn't necessarily have good Steinman properties. This is because the BDS ansatz contains three particle invariants.
Well, it's because products are lower than things that have separately three particle invariants.
Yes.
So you can, of course, have mixed things.
Right, yeah. So what you want to do is remove those three particle invariants. So what you actually need is some BDS-like ansatz. And essentially what this is since the BDS ansatz is some exponentiation of one-loop amplitudes, this is just taking the one-loop amplitude and removing all dependence on three particle invariants. So all the three particle invariants get shoved into this curly E object. Similarly, you can write something down for NMHV. So for NMHV, this expression is a little more complicated, because the tree amplitude is different, so you need to parameterize that freedom somehow. So what you have is...
Why are you calling tree factor BDS?
So this is the Berndixson-Smirnov ansatz. For MHV and then for NMHV, this is the ratio function, right? So it's BDS times MHV times ratio function. And there's a particular way that we set this up. Just put the plus cyclic down a step. So these objects I'm writing down here, so these things are what are known as R invariants. This is sort of a shorthand for a five bracket of supermomentum twisters, which can be written down as a fermionic delta function. Okay, I've switched into the wrong letters here. This fermionic delta function. Yes, plus cyclic on these variables. So these variables can appear in this. I'm marking it by the one leg that doesn't appear. And on the bottom, some Park-Taylor-ish denominator. So I think I'll just write this as times cyclic, where again, it's cyclic on 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. OK. So these objects parameterize the difference between the tree-level MHV and tree-level NMHV amplitudes. Then these things are our coefficient functions for NMHV. This one has even parity. This one has odd parity, just due to the fact that this prefactor has odd parity and this prefactor has even parity. And these things, so these three functions are the things we want to fix. Curly E is fully S3 symmetric. Whereas this thing is symmetric under U exchange with V. and each Weddell is anti-symmetric. Okay, so these are just the conditions for our ansatz to actually, this is how we're parameterizing these functions. And just making sure that we're parameterizing things with the right symmetries, we constrain our ansatz that much more. So here I'm writing down remaining parameters for MHV, remaining parameters for NMHV. So at one loop, you've got three remaining parameters, then five. At two loops, 11 and 24. At three loops, 44 and 106. At four loops, 174 and 451. And at five loops, we don't know, because as I'll say later, it's actually too hard to just impose this condition by itself. It's easier to impose later stuff at the same time. OK. And that later stuff, and that later stuff is something we refer to, well, the next later stuff anyway, is what we refer to as the Q-bar equation. So this was first figured out by Simone Caron-Poix, and Song He, who is probably in the room somewhere.
Yeah, he used to be sitting there. Ah.
I was going to gesture at him, and then I was like, wait, where is he?
Well, the laptop is there.
So uh-huh, okay. Probably some of this work was done by the laptop of Song He. So there you go. So the idea is that in addition to a dual conformal symmetry, there's a dual superconformal symmetry. And Q-bar is a dual superconformal generator. It doesn't annihilate the amplitude, it's anomalous, and its action on it is given by a particular collinear limit of the 7-point amplitude. And if you just sort of look at the equation that this generates, it ends up telling you that there's only specific rational functions that can appear in the derivative of your amplitude. So this Q bar is a first-order differential operator, it's taking one derivative. So it's telling you what these final d logs are that you're pulling out with a derivative. So we call it a final entry condition. It's constraining the final entry of the symbol. For curly E, it tells us that the final entry is in the following set. It's a cross ratio over 1 minus a cross ratio, or it's one of the y's. For non-curly E and E twiddle, it's tying them together in a more complicated way that I'm not going to write on the board because it would take too long. But the upshot is that we can build our ansatz with this condition in mind. And if we do that, things are, again, much simpler. At one loop, we have two parameters remaining in each sector. At two loops, five parameters remaining. At three loops, 19 for MHV, 12 for NMHV. So you notice that NMHV is now more tightly constrained because these two functions are tied together. For four loops, 72 and 32. And for five loops, 272 and 83. Okay. So not so bad already, certainly a lot better than 3,434. But still not a unique function. We need to keep going. The next condition is at least very simple to understand. Okay. What happens if you take a collinear limit of a 6-point amplitude? You get something dependent on a 5-point amplitude. But there is no dual conformally invariant quantity you can write down at 5 points. So all of this thing's collinear limits are determined by the breaking of dual conformal invariants. They're determined by the BDS ansatz. So if you know the BDS ansatz, you know the collinear limits of all of these functions. And
there's nothing that's dual conformal invariant. The R invariant is dual conformal invariant.
Yes, I should clarify. There's nothing at loop level that's dual conformally invariant. Everything, right, there are no dual conformal invariant cross ratios. You've got the R invariants, and that's it. So you can impose that as well. And once again, you lose a lot of parameters. In particular, one loop is now uniquely fixed. There is one function that obeys all of these constraints. It's the correct curly E to correspond to the amplitude. It's what you would get out of the BDS ansatz if you didn't make it a BDS-like ansatz and do this whole dance. It's there. That's not very surprising. The BDS ansatz already knew about what one loop should look like. What is surprising is two loops, which is also completely fixed at this point. There are no more parameters at two loops. That's done. Three loops, you've got a little bit left. One parameter in each sector. Four loops, three parameters for MHV, five for NMHV. And six loops, 9 and 15. This is almost at the point that you could imagine doing it by hand, except that the expressions these parameters multiply are way too complicated, and you would never do that. OK. There is one final condition to impose to get to the final results. And that is multi-regi kinematics.
So sorry, can I ask, so if you now impose these Feynman conditions lower, so does it lower the baseline or not? Are they already included?
Yes, so let's see. One thing I haven't looked at is sort of how much that improvement propagates down. Yeah, so I know that it cuts this line roughly in half at higher loops. I don't know what it does further. We're sort of still trying to find a nice basis of the new full Steinman functions that will apply to the rest of them.
So how deep down do you go into collinear expansion?
Just to leading order. So this is just to leading order. This is just leading collinear vanishing. If you go further, you need predictions from the operator project expansion, which we could in principle use, but which we don't need.
So in principle, there's like way more information in a collinear that you just haven't used.
Yes, yes.
Well, yeah.
There's, right, there's all information there in principle. And in fact, this is partially an answer to your question. Another way we know that we're not missing things, we can compare to this collinear expansion, and we can check first order in it, second order in it, and match everything.
I just want to go, like, if you want to eventually go to even higher and higher loops, like, yeah, you need more information, it seems.
No, and I'll get to that.
What I expect is there's a lot of internal consistency baked into this, just because these different constraints are probably not overlapping. So
many of them are not overlapping. Yeah. There's a little bit of overlap. We've gotten rid of some of the ones we used to impose that turned out to be very overlapping.
So I mean, it's not merely that you have a solution, which is nice, but it's a solution to a highly overconstrained system is more convincing.
Yes. Okay. So the multi-regi limit. This is a generalization of regi kinematics for more than four particles. We have two high energy incoming particles, and the outgoing particles are strongly ordered in rapidity. Now, in this limit, one of our cross ratios is going to 1, the other two are going to 0. And since I'm running low on time, I'm not going to write the full formula in this limit. Instead, I'll just sketch how it works. So in general, what this is telling us is that our amplitude is given by some Fourier-Mellon transform of an some impact factor object and some divergent factor to an exponent where the impact factor and the exponent contain the dependence on the coupling. So it's this exponential Fourier Mellon sort of setup. Now, this behavior is very well known. So this was originally explored by Fadin, Lopatov, Prigorin, and for NMHV, Schnitzer. And it's been more understood in recent years. So there's an all orders understanding via integrability by Simone Karen Huo. If I'm writing last names, I should be consistent and write down last names. Simone Karen Huo, Benjamin Basso, and Amit Sever. But we need essentially none of this information. All we need is the form of this object. Because what the form of the because the key thing here is this omega, it starts at order g squared. It has no tree level piece. So this thing is called the BFKL eigenvalue. And it has no tree level piece. So if we want to pull out a log VW, a divergent log in this limit, we're always pulling out a factor of g squared. So if we just look at only, say, terms in this limit of log squared VW and higher, we will never need information about these functions to any higher order than we've already gone. If we want to know what these, so if we want just the log squared in higher terms at, let's say, three loops, we only need to know these functions at two loops. And remember, we have one loop and two loops. And that gives us enough information to get up to these log squared terms at three loops. So three loops is fixed. That gives us enough information to get log squared terms four loops. So four loops is fixed. And that gives us enough information for five loops. And then we can go back and check and see that indeed we're agreeing with all of these integrability predictions, et cetera. But we don't need any of that. All we need is this exponentiation. And that just gives us the amplitude. OK, so I'm a little bit over time, but I do want to cover one more thing before I open up for questions. So you might ask, OK, fine, you've got this amplitude. Why do we care? What interesting things can I say about it? There are a few weird properties it has. And here's one we really don't understand and would really like to understand. And so all the various smart people in the room can hopefully put some thought into it and see if you have any ideas. I'm going to define an operator. Acts on some transcendental function f. And it gives double coproduct elements. So I've taken two derivatives, I've shucked off 2 log s, and it's some combination of that. So for example, f1 minus uu means first I pulled off u, then I pulled off 1 minus u. Some combination of these. So this weird combination. Why do I care about this? I care about this because I can use this, act on curly e, our coefficient function for MHV. I get g squared to non-curly e, the MHV one, and I'll give the particular permutation there, minus curly e, at one lower loop order. So I've taken two symbol entries off. I've got something two transcendental weight lower, so it's one loop level lower. And what this is telling us is that the NMHV amplitude, at least this parity even part of it, is entirely determined by MHV at one higher loop. And we have no idea why. This doesn't seem to map onto any relations that anybody knew about previously. It isn't Q bar, it isn't, as far as we can tell, some consequence of the OPE or of the multi-regi exponentiation or anything like that. It's some property that we don't understand.
So which entry are you deleting in doing these operations on the F?
Sorry.
The entries that you have indicated there, but in which place are they?
These are all the last two
entries. The last one, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
And yes. This is valid for all the loops that we have checked?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and I mean, I should mention that some of the in-progress work is we've currently got six-loop MHV, and are working on six-loop NMHV. And for six-loop MHV, the same relation holds. So,
I mean, there is another place where MHV and NMHV are related by one drop-in loop, which is from the correlator. So the four-point correlator has all higher point, lower loop amplitudes in it. So we have the 10-loop four-point amplitude done, which gives us the 5-point nine-loop amplitude, and it tells us the 6.8 loop is the square. Anyway, but the but as you increase MHV degree, it costs you extra loops. So to get the 5-point MHV bar, we get that at 8 loops, which seems a little odd because you get they're the same, but it means that you really get the full parity, even and odd part at 8 loops. Similarly here, if you wanted to pull off the MHV piece, you can get that from just going down 2 loops from 4. But NMHV is going to cost you one extra loop.
But this is all 6-point.
I know. So 6-point. So what I'm saying is that the 4-point 10-loop correlator knows about the 8-loop MHV.
But this is all in the 6-point line. You are not changing the number of points.
What? I know.
No, that's what he's saying.
I'm saying. But 6-point NMHV costs you one extra loop because it's. Because the correlator tells you about the product of the amplitude, so you have to break it into even odd parts to disentangle that, gives you, costs you one. Anyway.
Yeah, it looks
something
like Q-bar.
Yeah, I agree. It looks Q-bar-like. So part of the reason that Simone got involved with this, actually, is that sort of back at four loops, we asked him, okay, is this Q bar? And he spent a while trying to figure that out. It looks like it's not, but it's still unclear.
The difference is that Q bar on the right hand side, you are using the 7-point MHV, but you are only doing that in a collinear limit, so it's not conceivable that.
Yeah.
Reduce to some 6-point number, the next one will be a little smaller.
I think it's reasonable, but the fact that it is 7-point, even though it's the collinear limit of 7-point, makes it hard to see. Like,
a lower loop, do you see the connection more directly?
You mean in terms of specific integrals or in terms of?
Just taking the remainder and ratio. The fact that it's satisfied by this relation and the fact Q bar exists, is there any connection on lower loops?
This does not seem this. So one thing I can say is that this seems this is not contained in Q-bar. That is, it doesn't have all the information about Q-bar, or vice versa. Like, we can impose either set of constraints, and they don't fix the same things. There's some overlap, but they don't fix the same things.
By the way, how powerful it is as a
Pretty powerful. So this is actually how Lance got six-loop MHV. So yeah, this constraint, this is another fairly nice constraint on all this junk. OK. One thing I'm just going to briefly mention before finishing is that one clue that we have, and this is something JJ was briefly hinting at when everybody sat down, I can write this six-point ladder diagram. So this double pentaladder. You've got two pentagons on either side, a ladder in between. You can iterate this to however many loops you want. These things we've been hammering away at, and we feel like we now understand them to all orders. And they, and there's different numerators you can put on these things. So I'm going to be talking about specifically one of them that has this numerator, which we call omega tilde. Now, omega tilde, as it turns out, obeys this relation. X omega tilde L is 2 omega tilde L minus 1. So this operator, whatever it is, doesn't just act nicely on the amplitude. It acts nicely on this infinite class of ladder integrals, too, which is kind of interesting, because for these ladder integrals, we feel like we can understand them for finite coupling. So there's, if we can somehow bootstrap some of that knowledge to the amplitude, we can potentially understand things to all orders a lot better. We don't have a specific,
it's
right.
Not really the amplitude,
so. Right, it's these coefficient functions, yes. Yeah, and the,
So this was, you don't need to motivate Lance to go to six loops, but one of the interesting things to check is that I'm pretty sure it is true that there does not exist any local integral representation which term-wise lives inside the spaces. And the reason is because elliptic functions start happening term-wise at six loops, for MHV and non-MHV. And so while the amplitude is, I think there's no question, at least by anybody in this room, that the amplitude is sure as heck in this hexagon basis. The local integral representation obstructs that.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And I think one thing we've been wondering about is whether there's some way to see that from our perspective.
Yeah.
I suspect that there isn't, but...
How would you see that? Is it already R on the basis function?
Right, exactly, exactly.
No, but,
so,
it's conceivable that some of these rules, I mean, these rules can probably be translated into single Feynman diagrams, you know? Like, I mean, you can certainly talk about the collinear limit of an integral. And so you get a different kind of constraint from the whole amplitude, but you can certainly do it. And so you get versions of you can apply a similar kind of logic to an individual Feynman diagram. Mm-hmm.
But I would expect that so this way just each of them different differential equations. But this is a global differential equation.
Yeah, but it might, I mean, yeah. It would be very nice to have a integrand level version of the hexagon bootstrap. But starting at six loops, that is going to require some extension to elliptics.
For the omegas. Yeah, so for the omegas.
You can construct a differential equation too.
Right, yeah. So one thing I'm trying to remember is whether this follows from the differential equation in some way. I think for the omegas this is an observation so far. This doesn't directly follow from the differential equation.
But it seems very likely that you follow the same work of Ziara and James and Johannes.
That's what we started with for the omegas, yeah. And this doesn't follow directly from that, but I suspect there's some similar principle. The problem is you can't write this as a differential equation. If you tried to write this as a differential operator, you'd get some lower transcendentality pieces mixed in. Or rather higher transcendentality. You get some derivatives acting on rational bodies.
So is there a similar version for omega to omega L, not omega tilde?
Yes, but it's less interesting because it vanishes.
Okay.
But yeah. anyway, so this is the ongoing mystery of this setup, but we're pushing on to 6 loops, and we should at least be able to see whether these things continue and whether there's some even better basis that constrains things even more. All right, thank you.
Story's been done analogously at 7 point. What's the status of how high that's gone?
We have 4 loops, MHB and 3 loops, 10 MHB, but only a symbol level. Part of the issue with getting the choices about where you integrate off of these are done with gram determinant constraint. You don't have this natural integration base point. But there's nothing stopping us from doing that other than other projects. But that's actually maybe a more computationally easy way to get some of the 6-point amplitudes. Now it's just to take a linear limit of these guys, which are even more constrained at 7 points.
So for this equation, you said that you can write it as a differential equation by just loops meter, or
no, you
cannot write it?
You cannot. So essentially, the way that this is set up, it's relating transcendentality L to transcendentality L minus 2. But the problem is if you try to write down some differential equation that gives this, it will also give, essentially, whenever you act with a derivative, you can either act on the functions or you can act on the rational things that you've put out. And a nicely behaved differential thing that only gives something lower transcendentality will the actions on the rational stuff will cancel. But in this case, you can't write down something where the actions on the rational stuff cancel. So you'll have this, and you'll also have some transcendentality L minus 1 pieces.
Wait, so just to be clear, you said you can't. Do you mean you tried really hard and you couldn't?
I mean, I can write down a general basis of all possible derivatives and see if there's a solution, and there is no solution.
I see. Okay.
Because this is a 3-variable space. I just need 3 derivatives.
Okay.